Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
The fifth element is widely known now as knowledge, when back then, in mid-80s, it was known as beatboxing.
Yeah. The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 218 with Crazy Legs. Richard Crazy Legs Cologne is a b-boying pioneer and the longtime president of the Rocksteady Crew, arguably the most famous b-boy crew in the world. He joined the Rocksteady Crew in its early days and quickly rose to become its leader. As early as 1981, he was already getting press attention as one of the best dancers out there in the still new form of b-boying or breaking, and he invented many of the moves we still associate with breaking today. Crazy Legs and the Rocksteady Crew would make a series of genre-changing appearances in movies like Wild Style, Beat Street, and Flashdance, bringing hip-hop to Europe as part of the historic New York City Rap Tour, and even recording a hit album. After b-boying's popularity dipped and many of the original dancers retired, Crazy Legs reinvigorated the Rocksteady Crew in the early 1990s, spurring them and b-boying onto even greater heights, performing at Lincoln Center, winning a prestigious New York Dance and Performance Award, and much more. We spoke to Crazy Legs on the playground and in the principal's office at PS 163 on the Upper West Side, which just happens to be the home of Rocksteady Park. If you like the show, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/thecipher show. Every new patron helps Sean get a little more distance on his head slide. Go check out the rewards you'll get for signing up. If you want to know any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecipher show.com to find a complete list and the show notes. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what's going on with The Cipher. And now, here's the guy who even Wikipedia says invented the windmill, Crazy Legs.
Crazy Legs in Rocksteady Park, live in Rocksteady Park.
Yeah, Rocksteady Park. I think even on a sign over there, it says, I think it says a listing of Rocksteady Crew, the history.
There was an appliance store right over this way, right? That led to kind of an innovation in dance.
The appliance store right there on 99th Street in Amsterdam was pretty vital to the way we practice over here, because in the summertime, the black mat under the swings would be extremely hot, as well as it would beat up because of our footwork, and it would become dirty, and this rubber would just get all over us and stay in our clothing. So we would put the black mat underneath the swing. I mean, we put the cardboard on the mat underneath the swings after we would wrap the swing around the pole. And we would practice there all day and work on our spins and footwork and try to somewhat remain fresh. So that is where the whole cardboard thing started. And, you know, a lot of people thought that we walked around with cardboard, which wasn't the case. It was kind of corny if you did something like that. You know, if we saw somebody we wanted to battle, you know, it wouldn't be like, oh, hold on, wait, let me get some cardboard. Nah, we're going to catch wreck right here on the concrete or in this building or on the sidewalk, whatever it was.
Yeah. Frosty Freeze, who's a member of your crew, used to not only catch wreck on the dance floor, but also on the swings.
Yeah, Frosty Freeze was notorious for his acrobatics.
Frosty Freeze Frost was a Rocksteady Crew member known for his acrobatics, in particular for a move called the Suicide, where he would flip in the air and land on his back.
Frosty Freeze would do things like jump off the swing and land on the fencing completely balanced, and then do a front flip right after he would do that. Or he would swing so hard that he would be able to get up onto the top of the rooftop of the park kind of station house, And it's crazy because I don't even know if I thought that now or it's just like, you know, when you're a kid, it's so amazing. Everything's so amazing.
Yeah.
It's larger than life, and you start remembering things differently. But Frosty, I wouldn't put it past them to have done, you know, so many things because he was such an acrobat. He loved gymnastics, and he loved being the best.
Yeah. So there was also, you know, a big streetball component here, which you didn't actually fully understand the scope of until years later.
Yeah, right in the middle of this park, you have the basketball court where Cool Bob Love, my boy Bobito Garcia, used to play basketball.
Bobito Garcia is best known for his time as the co-host of the influential Stretch Armstrong and Bobito show on radio station WKCR. You can hear all about that in our interview with Stretch on episode 188. But in addition to all that, Bobito is a well-regarded sneakerhead, basketball player and commentator, and record label owner.
I had no idea who he was, or even if he was playing there. I didn't really have an interest in basketball like that. My thing is boxing and baseball. But Bobito ended up becoming one of my best friends later on in life as we started to celebrate this park because of the rich history that it has. But I didn't meet Bobito till like the 90s, man. And, you know, I learned that while we were right in one side of the park, he was there all day running full court games or being part of a league and doing his part with other street ballers and making this place famous. And it just turned out that it's Puerto Rican, talented brother. We hung out in the same park. And it's weird because this park had its own areas that people were dedicated to. So let's say in the daytime, you'd have basketball games going on in the GOAT area.
Mm-hmm.
And us hanging out over here or up in the front, you had greatness going on in different areas, and we didn't know. We just, yeah, you know, found out years later that we shared the same area and never really vibed with each other. You had maybe one or two people, like my boy Woody, who used to also play basketball with them. And it's like we didn't know him until he finished, and then he came back and hung out with us. But, I had no interest in basketball like that, so I never really paid attention to what was going on in that area.
Right.
And meanwhile, there was great talent happening. A lot of people are hitting me up as to what they should do and ask me what I'm doing.
At this point, we headed inside for the rest of the interview. I'll take this break to note that this interview was recorded back before Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico. Crazy Legs, who is, of course, Puerto Rican, has a home there, which somehow weathered the storm relatively unscathed. However, ever since the storm, he's been working with the same passion you've seen elsewhere to try to get Puerto Rico back on its legs. He started a relief effort with the rest of the Rocksteady crew called Rocksteady for Life, a nonprofit campaign to assist Puerto Ricans in the recovery effort following the hurricane. You can get more information at GoFundMe.com/RSCForLife. Part of their efforts have included trying to restore clean drinking water in the more isolated areas of the island. He's teamed up with the nonprofit Waves for Water, and they are all working with local leaders to teach how to use filtration systems he's providing. Up until now, these residents were being forced to use water from contaminated creeks. Of the effort, Legs told NPR, "We need to empower ourselves. We need to self-sustain." He also didn't mince words about the response to the crisis that came from the current White House resident. He said, "Trump's lack of care or empathy or sympathy is just one of those things where, why are you even planning to come to PR? Me, just a B-boy from the Bronx, how the hell is it that I'm able to get here before the President of the United States? How indeed." And now back to Crazy Legs, this time from inside PS-163.
All right, so we are inside the principal's office of PS-163. Sorry to give you any horrible flashbacks to your school years of having you stuck in the principal's office.
I had fun. You know, you get sent to the principal's office, you become a monitor.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So you just end up doing all these tasks.
Speaking of your childhood, can you take me back to the early history, even before you joined, of the Rocksteady crew? And I'm thinking specifically of its connection to the Bronx Boys and Batch in particular. Mm-hmm.
The Bronx Boys were a Latino crew that was founded in 1974 as a graffiti crew, but changed into the very first Latino rocking crew. Rocking, sometimes called uprocking, is a style of dance that developed out of the New York City gang culture of the 1960s and was a precursor to breaking. Batch, who took over the leadership of the crew from its founder Cash, was instrumental in moving the crew into rocking. Batch is generally credited with inventing the three-step move, a foundational move in rocking.
What can you tell me about Batch and the Bronx Boys?
When I got into the Bronx Boys, I was kind of put into the Bronx Boys too easy, if you ask me. It was kind of like, he was like, hey, all right, shorty. Yeah, you down with us. I'm like, all right, cool. I can be down with the crew now. I didn't really know much. I was maybe 11 years old. Mm-hmm. And being part of TBB was cool because it was like this big Latino crew. Not that I was thinking like that, but I guess maybe just because I could relate to them and just realizing that they're Puerto Rican, most of them. And they were cool with me and they were a cool crew to be around and be a part of. I had a lot of respect also for Batch being one of the, I would say, one of the leaders, that one of the people in the streets that you saw as a leader. And being that I wasn't part of any crew, I was like, oh, this is cool. You know, I appreciate him putting me in the Bronx Boys. And yeah, so.
And then the Rocksteady crew was originally the Fantastic Four or something?
Yeah, you know, this is the deal. When I spoke to Jimmy D about the history of Rocksteady.
Jimmy D, along with a similarly named Jimmy Lee, was a member of the Bronx Boys who was instrumental in the transition out of that crew and into Rocksteady.
Because I was kind of misled on the history because I don't know why I was misled. I'm not going to try to figure out the reason why, but when I found out that I was misled, I found out from Jimmy D that him and Jimmy Lee were also part of the Bronx Boys. And one night they were going bombing with Batch and these other guys. And their interest wasn't so much in graffiti as much as it was in breaking. And the thing about Jimmy D and Jimmy Lee is that people used to say to them, yo, you guys stay steady battling. You stay steady battling. And they ended up the next day forming a crew that would be more geared towards breaking. And since the dance was called rocking as well, they mm-hmm. called themselves a Rocksteady crew.
Oh, okay.
So Fantastic Four, I think, is a story that came from someone else.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so anyway, Jimmy D and Jimmy Lee, original president and vice president, makes sense. They're the founders. And, you know, if anyone else was a founder, I'm sure they would have had a role, co-vice president or something
right.
to the effect that identified them as a founder.
Mm-hmm. And so you, when you're around 13, you battle your way in.
12, 13, yeah. It's hard, you know. Here's
the
thing.
Of course, things get a little...
Well, you know, it's weird because everyone tries to be specific about dates. And to me, I like to say things with room for error because no one really documented on paper back then and on video. So I when I say things, I say them with room for error because, you know... these days, even if you're specific, it doesn't matter as much because the only thing that's going to matter in the long run is the outstanding moments, mm-hmm. role players, impact.
Right.
And then you get like, okay, yeah, you know, one day it's going to be like in the 70s as opposed to 73, 74, 75, 76, 77. It's not really going to matter.
Yeah.
You know, it's like what's going to stand the test of time, no matter who did what during those times.
Right. So around 12 or 13,
yeah.
when you first
joined Rocksteady. Yeah.
And there was a battle to get in that you actually lost.
Battling is, as you'd imagine, the name for a competitive dance-off, not unlike freestyle rap battles. Episode 95 guest Joe Schloss, in his book Foundation, B-Boys, B-Girls, and Hip-Hop Culture in New York, writes, quote, "Part of being a B-boy or B-girl is to be able to deal with any situation that may arise on the dance floor. This ability is developed, tested, and proven in battle. And the dancers do look at it as a battle. They will use their dance, their attitude, and even some tricks to make sure they come out on top." Also from Joe's book in Chapter 6, he quotes Alien Ness of the Mighty Zulu Kings, who said, "You know what? I am cocky. I do have an ego problem. I do got a big mouth. But it's part of the game. That's what keeps me grounded. That's what b-boying is about. Do you enter a battle to be diplomatic? Do you enter a battle to share energy and express yourself? No. You enter a battle to win. I don't care what anybody says. Everybody's trying to water down and put panties on the game lately. You know what I'm saying? I keep it real. I enter battles to win. I live off my dancing. I battle for meat. If I don't win, I don't eat. It's that simple. And I talk a lot of crap. I'm going to try to talk you out of your game. I'm going to try to talk the judges out of your game. And don't let it be a crew battle. Don't let it be a crew battle. Because if I got a tight unit, people will never even remember what our opponents are doing. You know, we doing routines on the sideline while you're breaking. I'm doing crazy stuff the whole battle.
Yeah, me and Lenny Len battled Jimmy D and Jimmy Lee.
Mm-hmm.
And we battled them in...
Underground Disco, right?
No.
No? Where did I...
Anthony Avenue. It was in Jimmy D's building. It was, on Anthony Avenue in the Bronx. Jimmy D's building, the hallway, lobby level. We battled. We lost. But we showed potential. And I think we were put in because of that potential.
Right. It's a few years till you pick up leadership. But you bring people into the group. And you bring in an incredibly high caliber.
Well, I didn't bring people in until 81, the beginning of 81.
Okay.
Because that's when I was given my chapter, the beginning of 81.
Which was when you were in Manhattan.
Yes. Because I moved to Manhattan in 79.
Mm-hmm.
81. But wow, there's so much that happened even within a short amount of time before that.
So tell me about that before you start bringing people in, before you have the autonomy.
When I moved to Manhattan in 79, I lost contact with a lot of my boys from the Bronx. It wasn't as easy for me to get back to the Bronx. I would have to do things like pack bags at Pathmark for change or pump gas for change. Things like that, and try to make at least $5 to be able to, you know, if there was a jam to go to the jam, pay your $3 to get in, have your bus fare, which is 50 to 75 cents, whatever, and get your pizza and soda and maybe walk back home after. I eventually started looking for people throughout New York City and throughout Manhattan to battle. If I heard about you being somewhere, whether it's your school or your sister's Sweet 16 or you hanging out in front of your building. And if I heard about you, I knew your name, I would go find you, walk up to you. If I had an idea with you and say, hey, are you this person? Word, all right, you want to battle? And a lot of times those people that I would battle, especially in Manhattan, they eventually started hanging out with me. And I would say most of those battles I won, but the ones that I won, they would also take me to people that they may have battled as well and say, yo, I want you to battle this dude. Because if they lost to that dude, it's like, and they lost to me, it's like, maybe I could use you to smoke this dude. So it became like a domino effect of battles and friendships, which eventually led to me meeting Frosty Freeze in Manhattan. I heard about Frosty. I met these other dudes in Manhattan. And they used to hang around 84th Street in Amsterdam. And I started hanging out with them. And my cousin Lenny Len was also part of a crew called Rockwell Association in the Bronx. And since I lost contact with Jimmy D and Jimmy Lee and the guys, I told my cousin, hey, you know, maybe I could start a chapter of Rockwell in Manhattan because I got all these dudes that I'm hanging out with. And might be a cool thing.
Right.
You know, because and I was also a part of a crew called Rock City Rockers even before I did that, further uptown where I met Take One, Little Crazy Legs, and all these other people. But all those things brought me downtown, and this area became that location where I ended up hanging out the most. And my cousin got permission for me to do a Rockwell Association chapter, and that was in 1980. So 81 comes around. Bump into Jimmy D again. I'm like, yo, I got this chapter of Rockwell Association, but my heart is with Rocksteady. You know, can I have a chapter of Rocksteady? He said, yes. So everyone that was in Rockwell Association immediately got transferred over into Rocksteady crew. The norm was you battle to get into Rocksteady crew.
Mm-hmm.
But since they were already down with me, it was like, I have a dope squad. I'm just putting them in Rocksteady crew.
And so this was the best of the best of people you'd found battling.
It wasn't even about the best. It was also about, you know, a cool hangout squad. Every crew didn't have all of the best people. You know, a lot of people had, you know, hangout squads. And when we started hanging out here, we had people who were roller skaters, graffiti writers. I don't know if we had any DJs back then. Stick up kids, you know?
Yeah.
Hangout girls, hangout guys, whatever. We had like the secondary family.
Mm-hmm.
Around that time, we had a battle with Dynamic Rockers at a place called United Skates of America in Queens.
Mm-hmm.
And when we battled them, we were like, oh, wow, you know, this was just voted a tie, but we were in their neighborhood. So to us, it's like, if we got a tie in their neighborhood, with their people being the judges, we really won, you know? So we had this gig coming up at the Lincoln Center Out of Doors program that Henry Chalfant had set up.
Henry Chalfant is a photographer and videographer who is one of the earliest people to document graffiti breaking and hip-hop culture as a whole. He is the co-author of the classic book Subway Art, and he co-produced the seminal documentary Style Wars.
And we were like, all right, cool, you know. This gig, instead of doing it the way we would normally do our performances, where we would split Rocksteady Crew up into Rocksteady Crew and Breakmasters and perform a battle, you know, we were like, you know, let's make this a real battle and let's invite Dynamic Rockers to be part of this battle. And we'll battle them on neutral ground. About a month before that battle, you know, Jimmy D realized that I had all these people in my chapter. And there was really nothing going on in the Bronx. Back then, B-Boys retired at the age of like 16, 17, the most, you know, and then you just move on. You go to Job Corps, you get your summer jobs and get a girlfriend or whatever it is that you're going to do. You go to college or you go to jail. He was just like, yo, you can have the crew, man. Just keep it alive. And that's how I ended up getting Rocksteady Crew. So even when you see Jimmy D and me standing in the photos, it doesn't say Prez on his shirt because the crew is already handed over to me. So he stepped down, but gave me the title. Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, before you really reinvigorated Rocksteady Crew, there was a little dip in the popularity of b-boying overall around 79.
Yeah. It was virtually dead. You were mocked if you were getting down on the floor by older people, you know? They would say, hey, why are you still getting on? Why are you still draining your clothes?
And then a new generation comes in and reinvigorates it a couple of years later in the early 80s.
Yeah, you know, there were certain people who were kind of getting a taste of what was going on, and maybe it was like fragmented and they didn't really know all the moves that were out there. So when I came into certain areas, and being that I had evolved the backspin into a faster backspin and the windmill, which was originally known as a continuous backspin, I taught a whole hell of a lot of people. And I had a lot of people down with me. I didn't know what I was doing. It was all trial and error. But I did know that if people broke off from Rocksteady Crew who were good, and they broke off and formed other crews or joined with someone else who wanted to form a crew, I never saw that as a problem. I just saw it as an opportunity for more crews to battle.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the moves you invented. And I was curious about what it was like to see something that you innovated, that you took something existing and put your own stamp on it. And then pretty quickly, it becomes just part of the vocabulary.
Yeah, you know, for me, at first, it was like, yeah, I got this move, boom, 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 everybody's biting it. And then in the 90s, when we started back up again, you know, my boy was telling my boy, like, yo, we're out here and, you know, people want to battle me with my own moves. And he was like, yo, Legs, you got to remember, you created something that went global. You should just appreciate the fact that everyone's doing your move, you know, and I have a totally different perspective on it now. But the thing is that the moves that I came up with, whether creating or accident, were the beginning of the evolution of the next phase. You know, it was what power spawned out of power moves.
Power moves is a loose umbrella term for breaking moves that rely on speed and acrobatic elements.
So, you know, when I look at it now, it's like, wow, you know, what I did was the DNA, or close to the DNA. Because even when I made up those moves, I was trying to do something different that already existed. So, you know, it's just the evolution. You know, I had a major part in the evolution.
Yeah, I mean, it must be crazy to think the equivalent of inventing a letter of the alphabet or something, right? Like just part of the vocabulary of the dance.
Yeah.
Wild. So Rocksteady Crew is a crew that's battling and you're gathering together. Within a year, you're performing all over the world and doing all kinds of stuff like that.
Well, in 81, you know, Henry Chalfant had gotten us some shows, and another guy by the name of Antonio Lopez had gotten us some shows. And
because you've been going downtown since like 80 or so, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we ended up doing a show at the Kitchen Center for Performing Arts in 81. And Tim Carr was the curator or director of that place at the time.
Timothy Carr moved from Minneapolis, where he was already curating punk rock festivals, to New York City in the early 1980s. In addition to working at The Kitchen, he was responsible for the early years of the Brooklyn Academy of Music's Next Wave Festival. From there, he helped manage NYC icons Laurie Anderson, Ardo Lindsay, and Eric Bogosian. After that, he moved into the record business, where he signed bands like the Beastie Boys, Megadeth, and Babes in Toyland. He died in 2013.
And Henry booked us there. We did a show called Graffiti Rock. And it was the first time, like, a show named Graffiti Rock had, you know, come to life. And it was also the first time that a show was put together. And this is before it was called Hip Hop.
Just to be clear, sorry to interrupt, this is not the television show.
No.
That would also have that
That
name.
Was years later. Graffiti Rock.
Now is the time for all the people all over the world to see rappers breaking, DJ stars rocking.
You can hear all about that Graffiti Rock on episode 45 with Michael Holman.
This is before that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Henry Chalfant is the one who came up with the name for an idea for a show. Mm-hmm. Not the name, the term itself, but the idea for a show. And he had Fat Five Freddy, this guy named DJ Spy from Brooklyn, Rocksteady Crew. And I don't know if it was T-Kid or Dondi who did the backdrop. Mm-hmm. So all, you know, these four elements were there, and it was the first time anything like that had ever been done in terms of presenting a happening mm-hmm. within the hood.
Yeah. Did you think of those things as being connected as a kid?
No. I mean, when you think about how old we are, mm-hmm. we were at that time.
You were dancers, you didn't necessarily
No, we did everything. I was bombing too. Mm-hmm. It was very likely that you did everything by default, not by a conscious decision. Mm-hmm. It was just what, you know, some of the things that were going on in the hood to do. You know, the same way we play Johnny Ride the Pony and all these other street games.
But it wasn't like these four or five things are a culture.
No, not at all.
Whatever.
That didn't happen until 82. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, when you think about, like, when people try to say hip hop started certain date, it's like, all right, cool. I get what you're trying to say, but the concept of having a goal or the concept of applying principles to it and the idea of having a name, an umbrella name to, you know, so that people can recognize the elements as underneath that umbrella, that didn't happen until 82. And you know, Afrika Bambaataa took the principles of the Universal Zulu Nation, and which back then was the Mighty Zulu Nation, and he applied peace, unity, love, and having fun, which eventually throughout time, there were add-ons to that.
Right.
You know, and it's funny because even with the elements being established, the fifth element is widely known now as knowledge, when back then in mid-80s, it was known as beatboxing.
Interesting. And some people argue Double Dutch belonged in the conversation.
Nah, no, that was something that was done in the park. It was all the elements were female and male. Double Dutch was a girl's thing. In the hood, just like Johnny Ride the Pony and Skellies and all these other games that we play Kick the Can, they weren't part of hip hop. Those were just something separate. But here's the thing.
Yeah.
Even with that, we can't forget that there were a lot of people who were just into rock that did graph.
Mm-hmm.
So
absolutely,
and had nothing to do with the fusion of all the elements coming together. They were probably anti that, if anything,
mm-hmm.
especially like the MPC crew, you know, and Cap, people like that. They were into something totally different.
MPC, or the Morris Park Crew, was a graffiti crew founded in 1977 that was predominantly white. Their most famous member, largely because of his appearance in Style Wars, was Cap. As you can tell from Lex's tone here and the following clip from Style Wars, not everyone was necessarily a fan of Cap, nor was he a fan of them.
Like, they went over that side of men.
Yeah, I know.
Cap. Yeah, I wouldn't mind if he would have went over one of my old cars, you know, but that was fresh. It was a brand new burner. It only ran for 2 days, you know. And he didn't even get a chance to run on the line. Just like, you know, and they went over in that field. You know, that hurt me, you know.
People don't know what I look like until now. Until they start going to the movies. They're gonna see my face. Big deal. Anybody tries to screw around with me and my friends, I go over everything they got forever. Everybody from Brooklyn to Manhattan. Everybody. That's the way it is.
You know, there's no denying that there was a large group of people from each element that all wanted to be part of this umbrella name.
Mm-hmm.
and we just happened to outnumber everyone else that didn't do it. So, that's a fact. And, yeah, you know, because people will fight you on, like, well, I was writing graffiti way before hip hop. I was like, yeah, okay, I was breaking before the name hip hop came about. So what? Mm-hmm. Now what? What do you want to do with this information? What's your point? You know, you want to validate yourself more than us. I mean, at the end of the day, you're still a legend. No one's taking that away from you, especially if you were dope, you know, had crazy style. You were king of your lines and a king of the city or whatever the case is. You know, that was all relative to your art, not hip hop.
Right.
You did a great job.
Yeah. How did Rocksteady Crew, among all of the crews in the city, become the one that is on international tours, is in movies, has the record deal, even though I know that went badly?
Because we were beating everybody. There was no doubt about it. We were beating everybody. Mm-hmm. Even when you look at Wild Style, it is the best of the best in there.
Style is the pioneering 1983 hip-hop film that featured, among others, Fab Five Freddy, Lee Quinones, Lady Pink, the Cold Crush Brothers, Lisa Lee, Grandmaster Flash, and of course, the Rocksteady Crew. It was directed, produced, and written by Charlie Ahern.
The only, you know, you may have some people missing, mm-hmm. but when it comes to the technical aspects of each person's art, not whether you can play records or not, but how you overall as a DJ, with scratching and cutting, your overall ability. Everyone that was the best at that time, from DST to Grand Wizard Theodore to Grandmaster Flash, they were the best. Mm-hmm. You have Afrika Bambaataa, who wasn't in it, and he was the master of records, but being technically sound in terms of the cutting back and forth and the scratching and things like that, that wasn't Bambaataa's thing. Mm-hmm. You know, and the MCs in there, yeah, dope MCs. And when it came to the B-Boys, nobody was messing with us at that point.
So we've had a couple people on the show who either were on the New York City Rap Tour in 82. Mm-hmm.
Get funky, hey, this pathetic dope addicts have to be abused. It's the same, what a thing to be a prostitute. Life
is given. The New York City Rap Tour was the first hip-hop international tour, bringing a taste of the New York City scene to France, the UK, and elsewhere in Europe. The tour included graffiti artists Phase 2, Futura 2000, Lee Quinones, and Dondi, DJs Afrika Bambaataa and Grandmaster DST, who's now Grand Mixer DXT, Ram LZ, the Infinity Rappers, Cool Lady Blue, the Fantastic Four Double Dutch Crew, and of course, the Rocksteady Crew.
Or, in one case, a woman who was in the audience.
That would be our episode 109 guest, the photographer Jeanette Beckman.
And then, you know, got into hip-hop from there. What are your memories of that tour?
Well, we... one of them was Take One throwing up when we were crossing the English Channel and the waves were all crazy. And he had eaten Rice Krispies, and those Rice Krispies ended up all over the deck. That was the one thing. I remember also us drinking a lot of brandy in the back of the bus.
Right.
Yeah, we were getting fucked up, man.
But it's weird, from home, you know?
The wild stuff is what I remember the most. I barely remember the shows. If I remember anything related to the show, it had to deal with the wild stuff. Like, we were performing, and I don't know if this was in the UK or in France, but we're on stage performing. Everybody's doing their thing. No, Double Dutch Girls were performing, but we were all there. And in the middle of the show, some people threw some bottles at them. In the middle of them, you know, being harassed by these people, Dondi grabbed his belt, which had a name buckle on it. And everyone just started grabbing, whether it was spray cans or whatever. And a few people went down into the audience and beat the shit out of these people that, you know, disrespected the Double Dutch Girls and basically almost hurt them. And they just got their ass kicked, man, you know. And the unique thing is that when they got back on stage, and we're all standing there like almost like a standoff with us in the crowd, just one person just, and it was a whole domino effect again. One person starts clapping, and then everyone started clapping. They just basically applauded us beating the shit out of someone.
Reading you talk about this era, early 80s, mm-hmm. when stuff really starts blowing up, I find it interesting that now, if you are good at something and you do a commercial or you do whatever, it's selling out, which is a concept that really didn't exist.
No, you. I mean, it's bullshit. Whoever, you know, usually the people that are saying that are people who have absolutely zero hustle and have no clue as to how to maintain their relevance. And then they end up with this bitter feeling and sense of entitlement that never gets satisfied. Mm-hmm. And it's like they're complaining about missing a bus that they either got off of or never try to get on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, it's like, all right, well, I understand you're going through it right now, but I'm not your agent. And some of them have to remember that when we did our first shows, we got paid. Hip hop started off as a sellout, if that's the case. And from what is supposed to be considered the first jam, you know, thrown by Kool Herc, it was actually
charged admission, right?
Charged admission. Yeah. 25 for women, 50 cents for men.
Yeah.
So where they get this idea that hip hop was supposed to be free, and that doesn't mean you can't do things and support the community and give. But there was nothing that stated, these are the four elements. You have to charge, or you don't have to charge, or no one should ever charge. You know, it's like people think that hip hop back then was this glorious thing. And for us growing up in a wild neighborhood, yeah, it was. But would I go back to that? Hell no. Because I also know that I didn't know what else there was that was great that should have. That I should have been on an equal playing field and rightfully had the opportunity for.
So what did going downtown so early on, you're a kid and you're going to this whole different scene now, and what did that expose you to? What was that like?
The whole different scene? We absolutely had no appreciation for it, man. Come on. We were kids. We were wilding out. We had an opportunity to make money. We wanted to make that money. Then we wanted to go back to our neighborhoods and hang out with our buddies and do whatever we did. I think one of the best things about making money for me was being able to, I remember the first time I made a $50, I was able to go to school and buy myself lunch the next day. I was at Kennedy High School, and I was happy to have been able to buy myself a decent meal at lunchtime for the first time.
Yeah. An influence of yours, I don't know if it's necessarily an influence, but an early dancer you admire that I haven't really heard you talk about much in detail is Spy.
Len Spy Figueroa, whose name came from Mad Magazine's Spy vs. Spy feature, was a b-boy in the late 1970s in the Bronx. He was known as the Man of a Thousand Moves.
Who was Spy and why was he
Spy
important?
Was the first superhero of all b-boys, at least from my perspective, and the people I had access to. You know, but it was more than Spy. You know, Spy was the king, but, you know, there were many people around Spy and you know, many people around the scene who existed. So I don't want to take anything away from them.
Of course.
Because Spy just happened to be my hero.
And he was Puerto Rican as well?
Yeah, I believe he was born in Puerto Rico as well.
You know, you've obviously spent a lot of time in Puerto Rico within the past number of years.
I've been back and forth to Puerto Rico.
Back and forth.
Since we started doing Jam on a Groove in the early 90s.
Jam on the Groove is a show Crazy Legs performed in that debuted in 1995. It was nominated for Best Choreography at the Drama Desk Awards in 1996.
I've been going back and forth to Puerto Rico, and I eventually bought a house.
Yeah. And so what is it about Puerto Ricans and Latinos more generally in b-boying?
Drums. I don't think it has anything to do with... I mean, these days, it has nothing to do with being Latino, you know, because Blacks and Puerto Ricans, for the most part, we grew up around each other, and we kind of respond to percussive music the same way, same feel. It's something that hits our soul, and you know, we have a Latino flavoring that goes into that, and they have their thing, and we do come together. But right now, it's really about the youth. What keeps the dance alive is. The youth see something that's energetic, something that they can compete at, and something that is creative. And you have any b-boy in front of a bunch of kids, the kids get excited and they get inspired. There's no logic to it. It's just instinct. You don't have to be Latino or Black.
So you mentioned this guy in passing, and I wanted to get into it just a little bit. There was, you know, I remember seeing an exhibit of photos from the set of Wild Style, and there's one of you and Little Crazy Legs.
Yeah.
So who was Little Crazy Legs?
Little Crazy Legs was a dude that I met up in Washington Heights. He was part of a crew called Rock City Rockers. And I didn't know who they were. I heard about them. My boy brought me to battle some dude that was the best dude in Rock City Rockers. His name is Kix or Kikito. And so Kix was nice, but he fell into things that messed up his life. And I replaced what he was doing in terms of Rock City Rockers. I battled him. I met him, and I met Little Crazy Legs, who wasn't Little Crazy Legs then.
Sure.
But even with that crew, since my moves were more advanced, I was teaching a lot of them. And Little Crazy Legs was my protege. And actually, the crazy thing is that when I did meet the people from this area, the 98th Street area, I came down here to battle Ken Swift, mm-hmm. who's known as Ken Rock back then. And after I battled him, I was like, yo, what's up? You know, your crew against mine. And that was when I didn't have a chapter of Rocksteady Crew. So it was Rockwell Association versus Young City Boys. It was 2-7. It was me and Little Crazy Legs against Ken Swift and his boys. And we battled them in Queens at a place called United Skates of America.
Mm.
Yep.
Wow.
And we won.
And you won.
Of course.
Wow.
Our moves were more advanced. It's, you know, there were certain people who were part of Rock City Rockers who had some gymnastics moves. Mm-hmm. Of course, Kenny had his flavor. Kenny, you know, they didn't have backspins or anything like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember seeing anyone do swipes, not continuous swipes.
Mm-hmm.
And we had all these moves that were the evolution of the dance.
For all of the acrobatic moves, right, in b-boying, both when you were getting started and now with a lot of the power moves and things like that, there is another element to b-boying, which is the actual connection to the breaks, the actual connection to the music, because it is a dance. It's not, you know, gymnastics. Yeah. Can you talk about that side of it?
I don't really think that has anything to do with, when you hear music, you respond to music, and how you respond to it, you know, depends on whether it moves you or not, and also who you are as a person, what your character is like, what are you going through on that day.
Mm-hmm.
That can determine the moves that you do, and no, the character in the moves that you do. But in terms of any direct link, yeah, I would say, you know, B-boys, Bronx boys, break boys, the break and the break, you know, things like that. It evolved into that. And so the B does stand for break boys.
I was going to ask about this because I've heard 3 or 4 different theories about what the B actually stands for. Is it Bronx? Is it break? Is it...
When I first heard B-boys, it was the Bronx boys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but also, it evolved. I believe...
Or beat boys is another one.
Yeah, but you know, I think I'm too young to answer that question.
Gotcha.
With, you know, in any absolute way.
Sure.
So I'm not trying to... take credit for the end definition of that. I just know what it evolved into.
Right. Other than music to break to, what kind of music do you like personally?
Me? Yeah. Shit. I was listening to some Stevie Wonder today. Chilling in the jacuzzi, listening to Golden Lady.
Golden Lady, I'd like to go there.
You know, and Inner Visions and all these other things.
Nice.
So I like jazz music.
Mm-hmm.
I like a lot. I'm pretty diverse. I've never been deep into rock,
mm-hmm.
but there are some rock songs I like. There's some 80s dance that I like. I even like some of the music that my mother grew up on, whether it be doo-wop, Latin soul. Mm-hmm. So I'm pretty diverse.
Okay. Excellent.
I know about Barry White because of my mom's.
Oh, okay.
You know, I remember when my mother also used to sing songs by Johnny Mathis. So,
yeah,
no, you know, that's really dating it, but
yeah. Right now, I think my mom was a big Johnny Mathis fan,
of course.
Too,
so I mean, Johnny Mathis was a pimp, he was a dude, man, he was the crooner for the ladies back then.
Chances are, 'cause I wear a silly grin the moment you come into view. Chances are you think that I'm in love with you.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, another crew that got a lot of media attention in terms of doing high profile stuff around the time you guys did was the New York City Breakers.
Mm-hmm. Ladies and gentlemen, homeboys, homegirls, the New York City Breakers.
The New York City Breakers, managed by our episode 45 guest Michael Holman, performed on TV shows like The Merv Griffin Show, Soul Train, and Good Morning America, and appeared on film in 16 Candles and Beach Street. However, they're best known for being the first B-boy crew to perform for a sitting president when they danced in front of Ronald Reagan at the 1984 Kennedy Center Honors.
You had a battle with them at a place called First Class.
Yeah.
What do you remember about that?
We smoked them. I mean, look, when we did Beach Street, we were under... I don't want to say manipulation, but our managers were trying to guide us because of the record deal we had with Virgin. Mm-hmm. And they were like, you guys should just use the people on the record to do this battle for the movie, blah, blah. I really didn't want to do that. I wanted to use my regular squad that I would battle with. Because Doze, you know, great up rocker, but he was primarily a graffiti writer. He had some moves on the floor, but he wasn't one of the evolved. He wasn't one of the best guys in rock steady. He wasn't known for being a hardcore B-boy like that. Mm-hmm. But you up rock against him, he'll smoke you. You know? I would have used people like my boy Flex and Spanky from the Bronx and a girl named Headspin Janet and Buck Four Kuriaki, Ken Swift, and myself. Mm-hmm. That's who it would have been. So anyway, I was upset that I wasn't able to figure out a way to have the squad that I wanted to use.
Be in the movie.
Yeah, be in the movie. So I was like, yo, let's battle in 2 weeks. Let's battle in First Class. And we battled them and we smoked them. It's probably, you know, that's a battle that it's weird because it's one of those situations where it's like boxing. Boxers talk about their wins, never their losses.
Sure.
So there are battles that I've done that don't get talked about because, you know, the other guys never bring them up. Mm-hmm. I had a battle with these two guys, Chino and Brian. And at that time, I believe they were part of Rocker's Revenge. They eventually became part of Incredible Breakers, a famous crew back then. And I actually went into their neighborhood. At the time, I had a fractured thumb. I had a cast on. So I went over by around 137th Street, which was very dangerous for me to go into. I could have gotten killed, you know, easily, like literally stabbed up, whatever. And I almost did get stabbed that day. But I went in. I did go there to battle them. I took my cast off and battled both of them. A lot of people revere them highly, mm-hmm. But that's the battle they never talk about.
Sure.
You know?
Tell me about the record deal a little bit and kind of how that tied in with Beat Street and stuff like that. I know it kind of went south, but so what exactly happened? I saw the video for Hey You, Rocksteady Crew the other day.
We got signed to Charisma Records. Mm-hmm. Our management at the time, Cool Lady Blue, got that deal for us. Mm-hmm. You know, we had a $1 million record deal and we basically saw $7,000 each out of it. We learned the word recuperable.
Right.
Okay. You know, so, right. But we had no idea, you know.
Is it
and
true
if we did, maybe we were too young and ignorant and we were never nurtured for this business. It wasn't a business that we wanted to be part of.
Yeah.
It's just something that happened and it's not like we were like, all right, well, we're going to do this and then we're going to take this money and do that and reinvest in ourselves. We just basically reinvested in the leisure time of our youth.
Right. Is it true that they made the record by telling you it was just a demo and just a tryout?
Well, I was in the hospital and they took five people from Rocksteady to Boston behind my back and told them that they were taking them there to just see if they knew how to sing, from what I remember. You
right.
know? And then a month later, next thing you know, it's like Rocksteady Crew has a record in the top 10 in the charts. And I'm like pissed off. Right. You know? I'm like, what?
But you eventually did the video shoot for it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it was an opportunity. We took it. We didn't even like the music, to tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. We never liked any of the music.
Yeah.
You know, we were being told that this is what you do. This is how you do it. You have to go pop or something.
Right. This kind of initial wave of B-boying calms down around 86. right? 85, 86.
Yeah.
And you are probably still in your teens at that point or early 20s?
86, I was 20.
Yeah, so you're just out of your teens, you're still a kid, mm-hmm. and you're done.
Well, yeah, all right, so here's the thing. 84 came around, Beach Street was out, you know, we were traveling a lot, but I was still hanging out
sure.
in the hood.
Yeah.
And I actually caught a gun charge. Thankfully, I won the case, or we played the system the way it's meant to be played. You know, and while we were getting adjournments, I was getting myself back in school. So by the time we finally got the case in front of the grand jury, mm-hmm. I was already in school for the past 6 months and on the right track. So, yeah. But, you know, let's just say it was a good thing I got caught that night, because the end of that night, had I not gotten caught, would have ended up totally different.
Mm-hmm. Is it anything you're willing to talk about?
Nah.
Okay.
That's for a movie.
I had to ask. You know, yeah, we'll see it. We'll see it when the screenplay happens.
Yeah.
So what happens in 86? What are you thinking when you'd been traveling internationally and on television and in movies, and then it's not there anymore?
Between 85 and 86, our managers were trying to get us to take singing lessons and things like that. And, you know, we did have a second album option picked up. And, you know, we became a dysfunctional crew. You have people who are getting high. You have people who... we're not interested anymore. You had people who were more interested than others. And, you know, it just ended up being that, you know, after everything, we settled out of court with Virgin Records, everyone just pretty much went their own way. Mm-hmm. I went back to school, went to Bronx Community College, and then I went up to, I went down to Hunter College, eventually dropped out of there, started working. It was kind of a rude awakening, because you also feel like, all right, well, I'm going to go out to a club tonight. And the club you made famous, you go there and the security's telling you go to the back of the line, you know? So that kind of had me a little pissed off. And I was like, forget all this stuff. I don't want anything to deal with it and to do with it. And I didn't want to watch a rap video.
I was going to say, yeah, it got to the point where you didn't want to have anything to do with hip hop at all, including watching music videos.
No, but, you know, for me, all that industry stuff, forget it. I don't care. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to deal with it. I didn't stop breaking, because if I went to a club and at the end of the night they start playing break beats, which is pretty standard, mm-hmm. I'd go down. So,
yeah. Restarting stuff in the early 90s. How did you do it? What kept you going to form Rocksteady Crew again?
I was kind of tired of the death around me. And I was like, you know what? There are a lot of people who died. And ended up on a certain path because maybe they came from a dysfunctional home. Maybe they didn't have parents who had an education good enough to be able to sit with them after school and do their homework. All these different things that lead to a person not necessarily understanding how to find that lane in order to be a productive member of society outside of the arts. So, but they still contributed to hip hop, whether it be Shy 147.
Like, you would try to, like, cause we try to talk it out. Nah, man. Like, I dropped something in the track, and I went down there to get it and all that. And you're trying to keep your hands in your pocket like this, and I show your hands.
Dondi.
My name is Dondi. I was born and raised in Brooklyn. I guess I got my start writing on subways. You know, writing on subways then in the 70s. Was a good way for me to release energy. It's good form of communication then.
Buck for Kodiaki, yo.
What are you talking about, man? I never stole no moves from you. All your moves ain't worth it a bit. So what's up with that, punk?
KBD.
Is that heartbreaking? Nah, it's like, it's called electrical boogie. It's like the robot, but it's pop locking. You do a move and you like hold it, and you like move back, and then you start floating, and you come back, you stop or do lean or something. And you just float and stop, and then you pop. And when you pop, you lock it, you hold it in.
I was like, you know, I'm going to do an event and pay tribute to these people.
And this was the thing that was part of the New Music Seminar originally.
You can hear all about the New Music Seminar in our interview with its founder, Tom Silverman, in episode 208.
No, it was never part of the New Music Seminar.
It was never part of it. Okay.
No. The New Music Seminar was taking hip-hop out of its programming. And as a response to that, we're like, all right, cool. Well, let's do Store Park Jam and take as many people away from the New Music Seminar as possible and give them what they're missing.
Ah, gotcha. Gotcha.
And we did it. It was poorly done, but the quality of the vibe was at its highest level. Mm-hmm. And whatever went wrong that day, sound-wise or anything else, what we did there created such a vibe. It was a rebirth of the Park Jams, except this time it's another generation doing it.
Right. And so how did you rebuild personnel, get new members of the crew and get that going?
Build it off of family vibe. You know, you also go back to who your best members were and see if they want to do it again. Mm-hmm. Some people wanted to, some people didn't want to do it. Some people's wives didn't want them to do it. You know, and so it became a convincing thing, you know, and that's what led to us doing things again.
Yeah.
So we actually did something the turning point in terms of getting back involved as Rocksteady crew, as performers and people battling, was when we were invited to, first, my boy Fast Feet, Jerry Fontanez, is like, yo, Legs, Rocksteady for the 90s.
Right.
So eventually, yeah, we started doing that. But someone reached out to me from SOBs and they said, hey, you know, Jimmy Castro's going to perform here and he really appreciates the fact that you guys used It's Just Begun in the movie Flashdance.
We'll have a link to this scene in the show notes.
And when he performs Just Begun, he wants to know if you're willing to come out and dance while he performs it at SOBs. Mm-hmm. I was like, bet. And that was actually before I even started throwing the jams. So when we did that, it was also Buck Four's last performance because, you know, shortly after that, he was murdered.
Gabriel Buck Four Marcano was a Rocksteady crew member who was murdered in May 1991.
That was the beginning of us getting back in there.
So you mentioned Flashdance. I have to ask, what do you remember about filming the audition scene?
Oh, the end when we filmed
at the end. Yeah.
Crazy Legs was a body double for Flashdance star Jennifer Beals for part of her climactic audition scene. When she does the whip back spin near the end, that's actually Crazy Legs. He's a maniac.
It's more about what I remember leading up to it. They wanted me to teach the two stunt doubles, the gymnast and French girl, how to do a backspin. And, you know, we just happened to be in Los Angeles at the time. I'm like, all right, well, I'll try, but you're not going to learn it. It's too, you know, it's going to take too long. You're not going to learn it that fast. So they had me teaching them. And the next day they came in with big bruises on their hips because I'm sure they went home and tried to, you know, lock it in. But it just... You know, there was no way that was going to happen. And they approached me and said, hey, do you want to do this? And, you know, I had a problem with it because, number one, my mustache was growing in. I had my peach fuzz coming out. And as a Puerto Rican macho boy, I wasn't really trying to lose that. So I was like, yo, you guys got to pay me some money, man. You asked me to shave my legs, my mustache, my underarms, everything. And I got to wear a leotard and tights and a wig. So I wasn't really happy about it, but whatever, you know, I did it.
Yeah, yeah. And it is a great moment,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty traumatic. I'll never forget having to, like, go into the bathroom and actually put those clothes on. It was weird.
So something you've done in more recent years that I know has deep resonance with you is your time making Bouncing Cats.
Yeah.
In Uganda.
I used to draw, I used to dance, I used to rap. Growing up, my role models were the dancers and rappers that I used to see on videos. People like Crazy Legs and the Rocksteady Crew, Shirimp and Shabadoo, A Tribe Called Quest, Run DMC, Common, and a lot more. Hip-hop was all I had.
Bouncing Cats is a 2010 documentary starring Crazy Legs and directed by Nabil Elderkin. It follows the efforts of the Breakdance Project Uganda to use dance to empower youth in the war-torn country.
Mm-hmm. Why did that connect with you so much?
Well, it's weird because I got more than I bargained for. When Red Bull called me up, they were like, hey, do you want to go to Uganda? Mm. Film a documentary. And I was like, hell yeah. Hell yeah, I want to go to the land, you know, Africa, where the land, you know, the origins of the beat. And when I got there, witnessing everything that I had seen, I was blown away, and I was just disturbed by what everyone was going through, you know, in their society. And, you know, it gave me perspective on what is, I guess, a stark reality for people growing up in certain societies. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, it could always be worse. And no matter what I went through growing up in the Bronx and up in Inwood, it doesn't amount to what these people are going through in Uganda. Mm-hmm. So it gave me perspective on my life as well.
For sure. We just passed the Rocksteady anniversary.
Yeah,
which,
man,
I believe was the last one in Central Park.
Rocksteady, 40 years!
Yeah, it was the 40th anniversary. I just had a point where I feel like it's time to rebrand. It's time to renew. It's time to also allow a lane to exist for the younger members of Rocksteady Crew to kind of take the reins on the dance aspect of it. Mm-hmm. and let them have their time the way Jimmy D passed it on to me. There is a transition right now that's, you know, a process, but it's happening. And we actually have a female that we're putting, you know, that we're training and mentoring to take that role. And, you know, that will allow me to do things with my project in Puerto Rico, which is Puerto Rocksteady Music Festival.
So Legs, how did you come up with the idea for Puerto Rocksteady?
When I was a little kid, Afrika Bambaataa would challenge me on my pride as a Puerto Rican. One day he told me, okay, you say you're proud to be Puerto Rican, so what is it that you're proud about? And I really had nothing to offer outside of the music and the food and just the fact that I know you're supposed to be proud. We have a parade in New York, and you grow up being Puerto Rican, but I couldn't tell anyone about any accomplishments by Puerto Ricans. And even knowing who Roberto Clemente was, I had no idea about him being a humanitarian and how he died being a humanitarian. So I started to learn more about what it really meant to be Puerto Rican, contributions of Puerto Ricans, and I started thinking, what can I do in the future as a Puerto Rican to help my people? Not even being born in Puerto Rico or anything like that, but just, you know, finding some real pride or doing something that establishes true pride. So I said to myself, one day I'm going to buy a house in Puerto Rico. I'll put my money down. and then I said, okay, well, what else can I do? Because I started to learn about the economy in Puerto Rico. And when you start to take into consideration all the struggles that the island is having when it comes to its deficit and, you know, the education here, you start, you know, me personally, I started to think, well, what else can I do? And I decided to, I said, okay, I have a name that I could use, you know, Rocksteady Crew name, my name as Crazy Legs. And I said, I could use that somehow to throw an event that's going to bring people in from all around the world and kind of create a music festival that just brings people here that are going to have a great time, experience the culture, experience the people, and experience the beauty of the island, and at the same time, spend that money on the island and leave it on the island.
And the next stage of what I do in New York, which would be Rocksteady for Life, which is kind of along the lines of what I'm doing in Puerto Rico, but for the New York scene. And you know, I'm really going multi-genre. I'm definitely reaching down to the youth. As much as I love my old school heads, they will always be honored and have a place in things that I do. Mm-hmm. But you have to focus on the future. You have to focus on the next phase of things, the new things, the what's bringing life to the dance floor.
So you might not be president of Rocksteady Crew.
No. Right. Yeah, exactly. As far as the dance component of it, mm-hmm. you know, but that also allows me to take care of them and make sure I can work the deals out for them as well when it comes to their shows and things like that,
right.
which I always found difficult for myself because as an artist, you want someone to be negotiating for you and you just go in there, you put the smile on, shake everyone's hand and be the good guy and let your agent handle all the other stuff.
Right.
You know, you don't have to have that kind of a tense relationship with a promoter or a sponsor and things.
Makes sense. There has been a movement recently to make b-boying a competitive sport and to put it in the Youth Olympics.
Oh, a dance sport.
Yeah. I think you have kind of mixed feelings about that.
Oh, well, look, the thing is, it's going into the Youth Olympics 2018, and by 2020, it's more than likely going to be in the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
I had an open mind when I first heard about it because I didn't know enough about it. And, you know, when I finally spoke to them, you know, they explained to me what they were doing and they said, hey, we would like you to be a judge. And I was like, all right, cool. Well, I'll be a judge if I know that there's going to be some sort of activation when it comes to creating a level playing field for kids who kind of grew up like myself, talented yet no opportunity. So if we can make sure that we're doing some outreach and workshops and just enabling those kinds of kids in those communities to be on that playing field and allow them to get into these Olympic Games, I'll be down. And the thing about it is I'd rather be part of it internally instead of complaining from the outside, because if I can have an influence on something within it that happens in a beneficial way to the community,
mm-hmm.
I best serve the art form in that way.
Yeah.
And if they don't do that, I don't know if I would be able to continue.
And finally, how are you doing physically now? Are you dancing? I know that just about last winter, you were at a point where you couldn't even really walk without limping.
I'm doing great. February 2016,
I
had lost my ability to walk fast. I ended up getting amniotic stem cell injections into my knees, and it gave me my life back. It gave me my quality of life back. I was facing, I don't know, maybe like a knee replacement surgery or something like that. But I had already had surgery, so the surgery didn't kick in properly. And I've been doing stem cell every 6 months ever since. And my quality of life, even from the perspective of being able to go on vacation and go hiking and go walking around and do the tourist thing, I'm able to do that now, where that was difficult for me for the past 6 years, and it was progressively getting worse.
Yeah.
So, I can't express how important it was for me to get the stem cell injections in my knee.
Nice. You still b-boying every once in a while?
Yeah, I was just dancing. What was I dancing? I was dancing in Austria a few days ago.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. All right. Well, Crazy Legs, thank you so much for being a guest on the show. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right.
Oh, wait. People can check out Rocksteady for Life on Instagram.
Oh, of course. Yeah,
yes,
definitely.
Please.
Once we got a chance to interview Crazy Legs, there was really no place to do it other than Rocksteady Park. It's not always possible to sit in the exact physical location responsible for so much history, and it was really cool to see how Crazy Legs looked around at the place while he was discussing his memories. Talking to him while sitting there was a truly amazing experience that bridged the past and the present, and I hope you got a sense of that in the interview. And hearing Crazy Legs talk about the history of the Rocksteady Crew and his own innovations really got to not only an important part of the history of an art form that changed the world, but also took a dive into the nature of innovation and of memory itself. Even if you don't know a windmill from a headspin, those issues are always relevant and fascinating. Join us next week when we talk to Curtis Blow. Rap's original superstar stops by Crosstown Studios to discuss his legendary career and what it was like to have Rap's first gold record. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it comes out, subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Make sure you check out our archives when you're there. If you like this episode, you should listen to our interview with a true scholar of b-boying, the author and academic Joe Schloss, on episode 95. By the way, if you use Apple's podcast app or iTunes to listen, go now and give us a rating and a review. It's by far the easiest way to help us out, which is why every podcast you listen to wants you to do it. Seriously, go now and do it. And you can really help us by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you a weekly show takes at least 20 hours a week, and we could really use the support. If even 20% of you gave us just $1 a month, Josh could finally bribe the mayor to officially change the name of the Happy Warrior Playground to Rocksteady Park. As an added bonus for our patrons, every month we share bonus audio that we get from our guests, either while talking to them after the main interview is over, or sometimes when they give us some extra special material. We've had behind-the-scenes production stories, unreleased Wu-Tang, and all sorts of things you can never find anywhere else, even on our regular episodes. Join us by the end of October to have access to November's file. You can find us at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Follow us and let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see on the show in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sataro.
Yeah, we were getting fucked up, man.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
I was bombing, too.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
You created something that went global.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
Dude, you go to college or you go to jail.
Our audio editor is Rob Van Vranken.
It was poorly done.
Our intern is Natalie Marr.
You know, I had a major part in the evolution.
Thanks to PS163 principal Donnie Lopez for letting us use his office.
They just basically applauded us beating the shit out of someone.
Special thanks to Eric Feigenbaum at Remedial Media for letting us use some gear.
We smoked them.
And special thanks to Patreon supporter Lucas Korecki.
You should just appreciate the fact that everyone's doing your move.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
Well, there was a Happy Warrior Playground sign in the front, and then they changed it to what that is. And it had, like, the history of Happy Warrior Playground, Earl Manigault, let's see.
One of these, like, basketball courts had a goat sign, like a Earl Manigault.
Yeah, and it's gone.